saw something on Yahoo about a big storm in the Northeast and Midwest.
I don't know about big. They just said, like, you know, some snow today. So I guess I'll find out the hard way.
A snow ice storm rips across northern U.S.
Oh.
Headed to you folks today, apparently.
Well, maybe it's gotten worse. I haven't looked at the news since last night.
Yeah, let's see. Nebraska, Illinois, Dakotas, Michigan, Iowa, probably hasn't gotten there yet.
And what are they saying the expectation is? A lot of...
No, I'm just looking to see here if they're, not really being very clear about the northeast part there. It's more like Midwest. It says a snowstorm headed to the northeast on Sunday after plastering a wide area of the Midwest. But that's about all they say about expected arrival time.
Well, maybe the flight will be canceled.
Are you headed out?
No, I'm saying it's, you're talking about it like expected arrival time, like it's a flight.
Oh, yeah, that could be.
At least let's hope the baggage gets lost, you know?
That would be a very nice thing. Mm-hmm. Just look on weather.com here to see...
Well, how much snow did you guys get?
4 inches.
Hmm.
That's a lot for our area because we're so close to the water.
Uh-huh. Yeah, we are too.
Yeah, it looks like, hour by hour today. Light snow, wintry mix, and through the afternoon, about an 80 to 100% chance you're going to get some.
Well, yeah, we got it ready. We got about an inch now, but it's very, very light.
I can't see anything that indicates massive accumulation, so... Mm-hmm. Looks like it turns to rain by about 6 o'clock tonight in your region.
Uh-huh.
It's going to warm up a bit, so it probably won't stay.
All right.
Who else do we have on the phone?
Sean's here.
Okay, Sean.
Hi, Sean.
Hi.
So I looked up the what you mentioned last week about... Yoshiyahu and then finding the Torah.
Right.
So, first off, it says right in the beginning that Yoshiyahu followed in the ways of King David, and he didn't veer left or right. That's impossible if he didn't have any concept of Torah at all. I'm certainly, and for somebody to be described as never veering left or right from King David, it's a pretty high level.
Yeah, that's true.
So right off the bat, and Radak brings down that the previous king was actually Amon. He only reigned 2 years, but Menashe, his father, was evil. Both of them were evil. But Radak quotes that Menashe had repented. And it says that he only sinned 22 years, but his reign was 55 years. So that means for 33 years... of repentance, Radak finds it very difficult that he didn't explain the Torah to the people.
Mm.
So for 33 years, never to refer to it. But the fact is also, when they found the Torah, the priests and those who found it, his Chilkiyahu, the Kohen, he found it, he identified it readily as a Sefer Torah. And they knew what the temple was, because this king, Yoshiyahu, had commanded to take money and rebuild the temple from all the destruction from Menashe and those evil kings. And he was getting rid of all of the idolatry, so there was a clear understanding of what, you know, the Torah was. It doesn't seem that there was any loss. He does say, though, that for those years that it seems to be a split view. It seems to be a view that would hold for the whole 55 years that Menashe, the evil king, was reigning. So he caused the people to forget the Torah. But again, we mentioned that Maimonides, in the beginning of the Mishnah Torah, so he gives the entire lineage of Torah from Moses down to Rabbeinu HaKodesh, who compiled the Gemara, the Mishnah. And actually, Rehud Nasi did the Mishnah, I think Rabbeinu HaKodesh did the Gemara. And there was no break. And that encompasses this era. So it's we don't have a parallel case where we were talking about last week how the generations of the Gentiles are completely you know, stopped keeping the seven Noahide laws. So you don't have that by the case of Israel. So I mean, it requires further investigation, but from what I saw, Radak found it difficult to say that, that even when Menashe was king, that the, he didn't explain the Jews later on in his reign. But certainly, it's clear from Maimonides that there were people keeping the Torah and transmitting it and making sure that it was intact. And you see that even when they found the Torah rolled to a certain place, which is an interesting thing, so the king took that as indicative of something. So he had them bring it to Huldah, who was a prophetess, and she explained that this was fortuitous about some destruction that God was going to deliver, but he would hold off the destruction until Yoshiahu died, because he was righteous, and it was a reward to Yoshiahu that he wouldn't have to suffer and see the negative, you know, the calamities that would happen to the Jews, because he was righteous. But then you ask a question, if there was somebody, a prophetess, so that means that she was keeping the Torah intact. And Yirmiyahu was also around, but they say that the king sent it over to a woman, a prophet, because she would have greater mercy. So the fact that you had, you know, prophets during this time, is clear that you had people that were upholding the Torah properly. So that there never was a point. And when they found the Torah, so, you know, superficial read, look, they found the Torah and we didn't have it all this time, but that's not true. They found it rolled to a certain spot. And that spot that it was rolled to was the curses, if the Jews don't follow the Torah properly. And that the king found indicative, and also the prophetess Huldah had substantiated that and said, yes, she gave a prophecy that that is indicative of the fact that God will deliver punishments because of the evils of the perpetrated by the Jews.
That makes sense. One question about his wanting to go to a woman because he thought he'd get a more sympathetic hearing. But if they're prophets and we really understand the idea of prophecy, it theoretically wouldn't make any difference who you went to, would it?
Well, perhaps he was thinking that there would be some sort of a merciful tendency that she would have, and she would pray. And like we say, that even if the sword is at your neck, you never give up on God's mercy.
Mm, right.
So even like that was the city of Nineveh that they, Jonah had to pronounce that there was going to be destruction, but they repented and God stayed the execution and didn't destroy them because they repented. So whenever a prophecy is negative and it doesn't come true, that can happen because God is merciful. But if a prophecy is good and it doesn't come true, then we say the person's a false prophet. Is any good that God prophesies through man, that has to come. That's how we know that the Torah talks about that. How do we know who's a true prophet and who's not? That's the determination. And not one of the words can, you know, fail to come true. Even if one aspect out of 100 doesn't come true about a good omen for the Jews, we shouldn't use the word omen, but a good tiding for the Jews. So even if the prophet said 99 things correctly and one was false, he's a false prophet and he's killed. Because nothing that God is going to tell through a true prophet is going to miss the mark at all. So, but then, you're going back to the Talmud, and about how God stood up and he measured the land and he released the Gentiles. So again, that's because that means to say that there was a complete abandonment. And I remember your question from last week, that how can you say every single one? Well, we're not saying it does have to be every single one. It could just be the vast majority, and it was such a loss that and it was a bigger crime because even this minimal system they couldn't keep. So, but it was in this specific case, the Torah says that God, it gives, you know, leeway for the verse for the rabbis to interpret. What does it mean to release them? It means that now that there's not people are not following it based on having a transmission. But we never lost the transmission. And again, that is something which God promises through the prophets too. If you take a look at the Uvol Tzion, that's one of the last prayer in the morning before the Olenu prayer, and there's a quote in there where it says that God promises that the Torah will never cease from our children's mouths and from our grandchildren's mouths forever. So he'll assure that Torah will always be available. I mean, that's the whole objective for man. Which brings us to what I wanted to discuss today, and that is the concept of God's plan coming full circle, meaning what his plan was for Adam, and how there's a deterioration, but then how in the Torah and in the prophets, God promises he's going to return man back to the state prior to his sin. So it says in the Torah that God, it's in Deuteronomy 30, verse 6, and God says he's going to circumcise our hearts, and meaning to say that he'll remove the desires from driving us towards sin, and we'll be brought back to a state like Adam before his sin, where he naturally was attracted to the good. So you see that there was an initial plan that God had for man. And it was only through his own sins and his own downfall that it deteriorated. And then greater commands were necessary. And then all the idolatry came about. And so many dozens and dozens of laws in the Torah are to combat man's sins. It's the Canaanite ways and the Egyptian ways. You have all these laws. I mean, had they never existed, you would not have laws to saying that don't copy the ways of the Egyptians. It would be ridiculous to make a statement, don't follow the Egyptians if there were no such people. Or if there were such people, but they were doing the right thing. But the fact that this makes up so much of the Torah shows you that this is really to address the current events and then the sins that came about. Of course, man has a disposition, but it was expressed through these peoples. But it's interesting that God eventually will bring back that state. So you see that the plan is really that man should be in a state where he's like Adam before the sin. And you know, something that we had going over all these Noahide laws for the past few months, you know, I noticed, I don't know if we discussed it, but it's a very clear contrast that the Noahide laws they're derived. They're not clear statements like you have in connection with, like, keep the Sabbath, wear a tefillin, honor your parents, you know, tzitzis, don't steal, don't murder. All these statements that are part of the 613 commands are clearly stated. You know, for the most part, they're explicit. Whereas the Noahide laws are all learned out from a verse that says, and God commanded the man, saying that of all the trees of the garden you can surely eat. So that was just a phrase that God said. It was an opening statement to Adam, where he said, you can eat from all the trees, and then the next verse says, except for the tree that's in the middle of the garden, you can't eat. But from that first verse where God says, and God commanded the man, saying, of all the trees of the garden, you can surely eat. So the rabbis and the Talmud derive all the Noahide laws, which is like, where do you get it from? So they take one word and says, and God. So when it says, and God, so then that's referring to cursing. Commanded, that reverse to sitting of courts, and so on. And they take each word of that each one of the words of that verse, and say, "Ah, oh, this correlates to another one of the Noahide laws." And even by witchcraft. So, how do you know the Noahides are prohibited in witchcraft? According to one rabbi, so he says, since it's together in a isolated, you know, sectioned off area of the Torah, or two verses are isolated. One says that any witch you shall not let live, and the next verse immediately following says anybody who lies with any animal, so he should surely be killed. Oh, so since Noahides are prohibited in bestiality, so, and it's together with the verse of witchcraft, so therefore witchcraft is also addressing Noahides, but it's also derived. So the question we came up with is, why is it that the Noahide laws are based on derivations, whereas the 613 are all explicitly stated? we discussed this yet?
We have not. It's a very fascinating question.
Right. It's just like after doing the different areas in, you know, the Talmud and Sanhedrin, so then you start looking at a pattern. And why is it? And Rabbi Yehuda, he has a very interesting position. He says that Adam was only commanded in one command, and that was knowing God exists, meaning not to follow idolatry. But he says, based on that, then he should also recognize that because, and this is Rashi commenting on the Gemara, but the Gemara, the Talmud says openly, once you have that principle, so then that means you should not exchange God with anyone else. You should not curse God. So he derives other things. But again, it's the same pattern of derivation. And this was all, you know, Adam and Noah's generation. This is the way the system was. So according to, there's three different views, it seems to be, that there's seven Noahide laws, or there's three, or there's just one, and then you have to derive the rest. But either way you go, they're all based on very cryptic type of derivations. And, let's see, yeah, the other ones too, I think, mixed breeding, and even like, for example, keeping Sabbath, and the Torah, learning Torah, those are also prohibited in terms of Noahide law. But those two are also based on a funny type of a way. Like, for example, keeping the Sabbath, so they derive it from a verse that says that you should work. So it's like a backwards type of a thing. Let me just read it to you. It's not telling you. Sure it is.
What's the source material, Rabbi?
Yeah, I'm going to turn to right now. Yeah, this is Sanhedrin, Thomas Sanhedrin, 58b at the bottom. Two lines from the bottom. So Reish Lakish says a person who's an idolater that rests on the Sabbath is punishable with death. What's the quote? What's the source? So this is after Noah comes out of the ark, and God says that since the laws of nature were suspended while he was in the ark, so God now says day and night will never cease anymore, and also winter and summer and all the seasons, God is saying to Noah. So that's not a command, but they derive from here that all the winter, since all the seasons will not stop, so that means to say that the Ben Noah, the Noahide, cannot cease from relating to a season as the harvesting or the season or the planting season and so on. So again, it's a derivative type of method that teaches that the Noahide can't keep Sabbath. And how do you know he can't keep Torah? Another very cryptic type of statement. It says in the Torah that they want to know why Torah study is not considered an eighth Noahide law. Why is the prohibition on Torah study not considered an eighth law? It's a good question, right? So he says, because it says in the verse in Deuteronomy 33 that Moses commanded Torah, an inheritance to Jacob, to the house of Jacob. Oh, so since it's an inheritance to the house of Jacob, so therefore it's not an inheritance to others. So that's a derivative type of method again. So you see how all these different laws predominantly are from derivation. But I think it comes to teach a very interesting thing. I think there's a very interesting lesson that can come from this. And that is that man, or the original man, Noahide man, was created so perfect and had all the tools necessary to live life just with intelligence alone. And even according to Rabbi Yehuda, said there was only one command given to man. So what's his position? His position is that God equipped man by his very design, that without anything else, without teacher, without books, he can use his mind to unravel what exactly his mission should be, what his lifestyle should be. I mean, intelligence can uncover great amounts of knowledge, just intelligence alone. And this is proved by the fact that the Noahide laws did not have to be explicit. Meaning you have the intelligence that you can derive it. That's what I believe it's trying to show you, this contrast, as opposed to later generations when the Jews finally got the Torah and there was such corruption and, decrease in man's own perfection that things had to be spelled out, things had to be addressed, and so many, too. So it appears to me that the original plan, and that's exactly what the verse says in Deuteronomy chapter 30, verse 6, that God will eventually return man back, because that is the ultimate state that man should be in, where he's actually living so in line with his intelligence. But it appears that God has to step in, like Rabbi Chait once said a few months ago, that it appears from his verse that God has to do this, he has to step in. But I'm wondering if that's the case with every single human being, because you see that Abraham was able to do it alone. Even after the world was corrupted, Abraham did not need any teacher or books. His intelligence alone was able to bring him to the highest level of prophecy. So you see another very interesting thing, and that is that the corruption which man started himself, you can find individuals that can undo that corruption. And it makes sense because God didn't step in and degenerate man to a lesser level. It was man doing it. So if man was able to corrupt himself, he can backpedal and get back to the higher state that he was in. God didn't make any type of a change that we're stuck with. Right? Adam sinned, but before he sinned, he was perfect. And then there was a progression. And then there was the people regressed back to infantile and superstitious and idolatrous ways. But it was all man's doing. So perhaps when the Torah is saying in Deuteronomy 30, verse 6, that God will step back in and circumcise man's heart, it means to say that the majority, because most people cannot do this without instruction, without direction. Their minds are just not there. But it doesn't mean the capacity is not there. You look and you see people that are like Einstein and Freud and Newton, and they're in the, there were great thinkers that were able to get back into that state of mind where they just were able to open up worlds of wisdom on their own. So that capacity is still there, and that's what Abraham was. Abraham was the brightest example of this person using his capacity. So it wasn't lost. It was just that people got into a pattern, and most cultures. You know, by definition, a culture means that people follow the leader. That's how you have a culture. Everybody thought to themselves you wouldn't have culture. So evidently, people are very impressed with what everybody else is doing, and they follow suit, and they don't question things. And that's why it just keeps spiraling downward. But you'll have occasionally individuals that think for themselves from the ground up. They don't take any type of a lesson from what everybody else is doing. They question it themselves. Is the idea true or false? What else can I discover here? And just the thinking alone is something which he can uncover worlds of wisdom. And that was the original plan. It wasn't necessary to give a whole bunch of laws to Adam. It's certainly according to Rabbi Yehuda, who said it was only one law he was given. And to me, what was the reason why God only gave one law, that you should accept God? Because you do need, even from being in the world itself, but for example, if man was just created and there was no relationship, there was no communication between God and man. So man can discover God. But the question is, what would my role be? So perhaps it is necessary to have at least one command in order that now that sets the stage of the relationship between man and God. Now I know that God's the commander and I'm the servant. But without that command, I don't know. But that is the one necessity which perhaps Rabbi Yehuda is trying to point to. But once he has that, then he could work out his entire life. And the mind itself is capable of working at all areas of knowledge. To me, that's the real lesson of why all the Noahide laws, the few that we have, are through a derivative type of a process and not explicitly stated. Because you don't need to say something explicitly to a person who's at a very high level. They could work it out. They could figure out what the right ideas are. It doesn't have to be an open statement.
Rabbi?
Yes.
Could you go back again and clarify, when you said that the Noahides were not to keep Torah or something to that effect, what does that mean?
Right, in terms of studying Torah outside of their laws, there's a prohibition today on that. A Noahide is only allowed to study Torah that is based on the laws he follows, and if he wants to keep more, again, the seven are just a minimum.
Okay.
And definitely keeping more, Maimonides says, we don't hold back the Noahide if he wants to keep it exactly as he does it, because he's going to benefit, or she's going to benefit exactly as anybody else by keeping this law. It's just a seven or a minimum, but if you keep more, certainly you have to study them, you have to understand how to do it. As Rabbi Chait explained, any area that has to do with perfection, certainly a Noahide must study. But it's, if a person is not going to take on a certain law, so then he's just studying it for the theoretics. So now, I believe what Rabbi Chait said in that case is that the person is then only studying, the Noahide is only studying for theory, but that's not his role. His role is not to be the educator of Torah. That's the Jew's role. And that's why the old areas of theoretical law and practical law are available to the Jew study. Everything the Jew has to study, because he's the one that God selected to keep the Torah for the rest of the nations and teach it to the rest of the nations. And as we see, like I was reading through in the beginning of the Mishnah Torah, so the whole lineage from Moses to Rabbeinu HaKodesh, and you know, the 40 generations, and you had in there the converts that were part of the transmission, no less than, you know, a born Jew. So, but they selected to keep all the laws, so everything was open to them. They were on the same footing as a Jew. So, but if a person's not deciding to take on the other laws, so then just the theoretical discussion is not open. That's something which is left for the Jew, because we have to maintain one focused group who the world can look at as being the sole authority of Torah. So, but if the Noahide starts to learn, or if the Noahide starts to keep Shabbos, so now it blurs the lines of who's the true authority. They look like they're doing the same thing. But since the Jews, the obligation for all the laws, that'll ensure a much more meticulous adherence and study of the law, and he will actually be a much more efficient teacher. So we reserve the role of Torah educator to the Jew, and also the study of it to the Jews. So this way, it's for everybody. It really benefits the entire world. And the fact that the Jews have to study all the Torah and make it available to everybody, that means that the potential for any human being to follow all the Torah is there. Otherwise, what's the Jew studying it for? Is he studying it for himself? True, but it's interesting. You know, the law where we derive that a Jew has to study Torah, it doesn't say, thou shalt study Torah. It says, you should teach it to your children. So, since you have to teach it to your children, therefore you must know it yourself. But isn't it interesting that the very law that teaches that we must learn Torah is vocalized as, and you should teach it to your children? Meaning it's a transmittive design to the law. It's telling you that on equal footing with your study is the transmission. You see? Because if you just tell me that you have to study Torah, so I'll say, you know, because that's because it's important for me to study Torah. The objective is for me. That's not true. It's telling you the equal objective of you is to pass it on, to ensure that others have it. And it's not just the Jew. It's clear that it's for the entire world. And that's what the Torah says, that the other nations will see the Torah, they'll see the statutes that you follow, and they'll say, what a wise and understanding people this is. That means that's God's desired response, is that the entire world sees the Jew operating and following the laws, and then he's completely impressed with it. So that means God wants the other nations to be impressed with our statutes. That doesn't mean only the statutes of the Noahide. It means all the statutes. So when we fulfill something like keeping kosher, so then the other nations will see it and they'll be impressed if we do it properly. So it really appears that we are safekeeping the whole system primarily for the whole purpose of the world for transmission. And that means that the entire system, so this way anybody who wants to follow it can. And let me just see that Rosora has a question on the screen. She's saying, I remember Rabbi Chase said that said in an audio class that Torah was of public domain. Does it mean written Torah can be studied for everybody, and the restriction regards just oral Torah? No, the restriction resort is on what is not Noahide law. So I believe that would straddle both. But I would have to actually hear what he said, because maybe he had a different intent there. But my understanding is that what is prohibited in terms of Noahide study is that which is not part of perfection, meaning in terms of like looking at the stories of the patriarchs and the matriarchs and seeing how they lived, things of that era. Because of course every law is to perfect it somehow. But if your Noahide is not going to keep kosher, so then the study of the theoretics of kosher would be off limits.
Rabbi?
Yes.
With regard to the teaching of Torah, so if you're saying that's reserved for the Jews, where does that leave Noahides who are teaching other Noahides?
That, of course, makes sense. We're talking about what's outside the Noahide parameters.
Okay.
Right. But again, this is my thinking, and I didn't see this written anywhere, but my thinking is that the reason why there's this prohibition on Sabbath and also on Torah study, again, is to maintain the exclusive role of Torah educator just for the Jew, in order for the whole world then to have a safe transmission. Because if people who are not obligated in all the 613 now started to teach Torah, so since there's no obligation, I mean, clearly it's going to be less of an adherence to the study, certainly to the practice, and then what they're transmitting is then going to be a corrupted form of Torah. And you don't want that. You want people to have the closest thing to the truth as possible, as humanly possible. So when the Jew has all these obligations, and he has to study it to know how to practice it, he'll be the best one to transmit to the Noahides and the rest of the Gentile world what the accurate representation of the law is, if they want to keep more laws. So he's the one that they go to, because he has the obligation to keep it. So he's going to have to study it. So it's really for the Jew and the Gentile alike that this law, it makes sense. Makes sense to you?
Yes, it does. Thank you.
Okay. All right. Let's see. To cover the agenda law. Mm-hmm. Right, so you see that again, just to reiterate the point, that God's plan is clearly going to come full circle in the future, that he will make a change for mankind, so we will be back to that state where we do naturally desire the good and intelligent lifestyle. It'll be something that internally we gravitate towards. And you see, that's what Adam was doing. He was naming the animals. He was defining creation. That means he was involved in intelligence, you know, prior to this sin.
Do we have any sense of whether that's going to be sort of a cataclysmic across-the-board event, or if that's going to be a period at which certain individuals will reach that state depending on, you know, something specific to them?
I don't know. It's a good question. I don't know. It also goes along with the question in terms of resurrection of the dead. Is that everybody, or is it just some righteous people and they live forever here on earth, which is Nachmanides' view, or do the people die once again after they came back? A lot of things about the future, it's cryptic, and it makes sense to be cryptic, because if the whole objective of our lives is to be involved in wisdom for the sake of really appreciating wisdom, so the more the carrot is dangled in front of us, the less we want the wisdom, the more we want this carrot, whatever this imaginary reward is. So then we're not studying because we really just enjoy the here and now idea that we just came across. then we have some imaginary thing in the future, which that's why my understanding is of why the next world is not something which is, you know, so much talked about. Because the more you talk about the reward, the less you're going to get it, because then you're not focusing on that which really entitles you to the reward. Meaning to say that the person is really who reaches the highest level in life is the one who is using his intelligence, because that's what God gave us in no other creation, and using that intelligence to perceive ideas and to really be drawn to it with no other motive. He has no other motive. A person is really learning lishma, which means learning for the sake of the beauty of the idea, does not have in the back of his mind some sort of ulterior motive. He may start out that way because he doesn't have the concept of what the enjoyment, the appreciation of wisdom is. It's one of the hardest things to explain to somebody. It's like telling a blind person what color is. So it's a very difficult thing. A person just has to jump in and start to practice and, you know, and study and become adept at Talmudic thinking and studying the Torah, and then after time he starts seeing an idea here and an idea there, and he should learn from you know, very, you know, sharp minds, so this way he can get a good sampling of what it means to enjoy an idea. And after time goes on, a decade or two, so then, wow, this is very interesting, and everything else in life pales by comparison. And then his enjoyment for study is for the study itself. So then what happens to a person like this after they die? So then that mind, that soul, that continues to exist, because death is only a physical event. It's not a spiritual event. Physical death is just the body stops, but the soul still exists. So that soul, which became so attached to interesting ideas in life, is now less restrained, because now there's no need for sleep or eating. And there's no distraction, and now the soul can be so much more attached to that enjoyment. But if the enjoyment was never accomplished, if the enjoyment was never arrived at in our life here on Earth, so it can't happen in the next world. That was a Talmud we did last week. Only those who prepare for the Sabbath will eat on Sabbath. Meaning only those who toil and study and spend their time in this life coming to learn and sharpening their minds, then they can actually enjoy what the next world's all about. So, but if a person is not doing that, and they're just begrudgingly going through the laws, whether they're 7 or 613, and just because he's got the promise of some reward, then he's really missing the boat. Yeah, there'll be some reward. He is following God. He is keeping the commands. But you can't compare that to a person who, because if, you know, the greatest command in the Torah is studying Torah. See, the practice of the laws is really to show our conviction that what we say and what we think is true to us, because that's how a human being is wired. Conviction is only measured as being real conviction when we follow through an action. A person talks about how great charity is but doesn't give a dime. Well, his value of charity is highly questionable, to say the least. So the practical is merely to show the conviction of the ideas, but the ideas are the primary, meaning understanding and coming closer to God and appreciating wisdom is really the objective. So if a person is not doing that and he's going through the motions, so what type of enjoyment in the next world can he have? He never came to the point where he enjoyed wisdom. He's just going through the motions begrudgingly. But the person who really studies and he really sees the ideas and he enjoys them, so then he's not looking for anything else. That'll be the person that really enjoys the next world. So since we touched on it, we figured it's good just to go over, because it's very fundamental. It's hard, because once you have the concept of reward, then you're looking for the reward. Any questions?
I don't think so. Thank you. That's very clear.
Okay. All right. Let's see. It is also interesting, one thing I saw this week, I was looking at the very end of Ethics of the Fathers. So it says that God has five acquisitions in his world. Torah is one. The heavens and earth are two. Abraham is three. Israel is four. And the temple is five. That's an interesting statement. That it means that God has five acquisitions in his world. What does that mean, acquisitions? And what are these five? But you know, again, we mentioned Abraham earlier, and it would seem to me. And I look at Rashi. Rashi makes an interesting statement that he created Abraham because he was going to attract people towards following God. Now that doesn't mean that he controlled Abraham's free will, but it means that he made somebody as great as Abraham, and it was for the benefit of the world. But Abraham still earned his own reward. I mean, you don't have Einsteins walking every square block of the street. They're, you know, few and far between. But it is interesting that perhaps what that's saying is that there are certain objectives in God's creation. So one objective is, of course, the primary objective is Torah. So, and it's going in a sequence, too. It's going in a chronological order. Of sorts. So Torah, I mean, wisdom, knowledge of God is really the primary objective. That's the whole reason why the earth was created. And heaven and earth is, of course, the backdrop, or you can call it even the laboratory, for man to study God's creation. So you have the metaphysical world, which is Torah, and then you also have physical world, which evidences the Creator. So that, those two work together. So that's heaven and earth. And then you have an Abraham as being the next acquisition, meaning the next purposeful creation, you could put it. What are the primary things that God created? So an Abraham who brought about and also set an example. See, this is where I think it ties into what we're talking about, that Abraham is really a shining example for all mankind that you can really reach God independently. Now, yes, he was on a much higher level, but at a certain level, that still means that every man shares that capacity. It's just the quantitative degree that he excelled. But and then, of course, you have Israel, that it's to embody the system for the rest of the world, meaning as an ongoing. See, Abraham was one individual, but Israel is continually throughout time. So that's why you need Israel as well, because then you can see if Abraham is teaching the people, what do you need Israel for? No, because Israel means the continuous generations. And then finally, what's the temple? Why is temple the last? Because then there is now the need for man's expression to God, in order that, because man needs to express himself. That is the nature. You see, that's what they tried to do with the golden calf. And Sforno says that the reason why the temple was created and became part of the Torah system is because it needed to be a correction for the golden calf, meaning the golden calf was man's unbridled approach to relate to God physically. So since there was a need to do this, so God created a temple, which was a very controlled system. Every single law, there's so many in temple. How you hold the animal when you're carrying it for the sacrifice, and where do you sprinkle the blood, and the measurements of all the different vessels, and the laws, and when you can go in here, and when you can go in there, and when you have to immerse yourself in a ritual bath, and so on and so forth. So this gives man his needed expression, because we are human, we have emotion, and we do need to express. So that's the last part, man's expression to God. But the first four, really, in terms of God's institutions to allow man to be able to see him. So you need a system of Torah. You need the ideas of God's justice. And a system, because for man, in the most part, is not like an Abraham who could figure out the Torah system on his own. Mankind needs to have instruction, so that's Torah. But the physical world then embodies the natural laws, and it gives man the other half of the picture in terms of God, the Creator. And then, of course, you have Abraham, who exemplifies man par excellence. Then you have the Jewish nation that will carry the Torah for the rest of the world. And then you have temple, where not only the Jews, but the entire world is allowed and should come and sacrifice to God and to recognize God. The final expression, which we talked earlier about. Ideas are good, but if they don't follow through with expression physically, so that shows that our conviction is lacking. So when we say that God has five acquisitions, it means purposeful creations that target the primary goal of why he created the earth, why he created man, and so on.
Rabbi, can I go back just a second to what you were talking about with regard to gathering wisdom and knowledge and studying? Mm-hmm. It seems like that if you look at one of the sages, Rashi or Rambam or Rabbi Akiva or one of those guys, they spent their days in learning. And they spent their days in learning because they really wanted to be there. I mean, it's not like somebody told them they should.
Right.
When you are getting involved in learning, you know, there's a certain amount that you do, but then there are all kinds of other things involved in the world. I spoke with, you know, someone recently who had some time off, and they said they did a lot of fishing, learned how to tie flies, there are a lot of other activities you can get involved in the world. And on one hand, it seems like the ideal that we see is the person who is just involved in learning from morning till night. On the other hand...
Not true at all.
I'd love if you'd elaborate on that.
Well, you see that the Pirkei Avos is clearly in many places that it says that, first of all, you should minimize your work and maximize your learning. It doesn't say you should eliminate your work. Now, are you asking in terms of their involvement in work or just in terms of traveling or just a more mundane activity?
Yeah, other activities you can be involved in. You know, you've studied a certain amount and then you decide, you know, I want to go spend some time gardening or I want to go spend some time on a hobby or something like that. I mean, you could say, well, this is good for my psyche. On the other hand, you could say, well, I really ought to be using this time for learning because, I mean, there's this fine balance, I think, between being drawn to learning and almost subtly guilting yourself into learning, if that makes sense.
Well, a person who really gets to, it may take time, and I think it will take time for every person to reach the point where they really find it enjoyable. You know, if a person stays with it and they have the proper teachers, I think they will enjoy that childhood curiosity that unfortunately, you know, the school systems kill because they just make it into a memorization and regurgitation type of a cycle. But there's no real, fun part. You know, thinking about things and training the kids how to think, it's not a subject, which it should be. But if a person does live properly, he will eventually. A person has to know their limits too, and not everybody is cut out to be studying for 16 hours a day or 5 hours a day. A person has to know what his capacity is and be honest with himself, and nobody else can tell him that other than himself. And if there are enjoyments, I know myself. I love a nice sunny day. Nothing I like better than to, you know, get into a convertible, drive upstate, and just, you know, have a little jazz in the background and to just take in beautiful scenery. And it's such a good thing for release because you do need a change. And if a person denies himself that, I mean, the Talmud says, a person passes by a single fruit and doesn't enjoy it, he's judged for that in the next world. I mean, it's wrong. We have senses, we have the need for enjoyment. It even says that, b'chol avos nafshechol tochal basar, that I remember Rabbi Chay talking about that verse, that when you have a desire for meat, then you should eat it. But you shouldn't be eating meat on a regular basis, because then you're just giving into gluttony. But there is a natural desire to enjoy a good steak, and a person should satisfy that. There's a need for change of scenery, to see family. You feel you haven't seen your brother in a while, your parents. So, and there's also, you know, of course, that you have the obligation to honor your parents, and that I believe even they say the oldest brother is combined with that. But you know, the numerous animals, what are they? They're not to be looked at and studied. The beautiful mountains and not to be visited, you know, throughout the year, or to go to see a nice lake or take a rowboat out of them. These things are, you know, a person has to measure, but the truth is those are not needed on such a regular basis. And the truth is, if you would have it on a regular basis, it wouldn't really do what it's supposed to do. It wouldn't give you that release. For the most part, the person's involved in studies, he's going to find that he gets preoccupied with it, and it takes really no exertion, so it could be a real enjoyable activity on a regular basis, and he will gravitate to it more and more, and he'll see that it'll start loosening up. And he shouldn't stifle himself. A person shouldn't do that, because then what's going to happen? He's going to really want to go for a drive, take a vacation. He sits down with the top in front of him, and he's just frustrated. So what type of learning is he going to get? If a person needs a break, he has to recognize it. And you know, all these different things in terms of, you know, like the Talmud says, you have to, if you don't, and also in terms of work, if you don't have a livelihood, you can't learn. So working is important as well. And you should do the type of work that you enjoy. Things that are, that, you know, something which really, you know, some people like to do like carpentry work. Some people like to do medical work. And whatever the, you have to, you know your own nature. And you see clearly that people do gravitate to different things, but that makes sense. Because the world needs to have all different types of experts. Otherwise, if everybody became a plumber, nobody would have a house because there were no carpenters. And if vice versa, if everybody came, you know, build houses, but there's no plumbing, so you'd have tremendous toil to get water and for getting rid of refuse. So you see that people have different tendencies. And but in terms of, you know, the balance, that's something you have to realize. And yes, the goal should be being involved in study and teaching as much as possible, of course. And, you know, transmitting it to the children, to the friends, and friends' children, and, you know, and others. But yeah, I think the need itself is designed in a way that a person doesn't, you know, the need for the release is by definition a minimum amount of time. And that's what release means.
That makes sense. Thank you.
Yeah. So if the mind's eye is on focusing on the truth, I think a person will also include psychology in his study, and he'll, like we're discussing here, like, well, let's look at the interview. What really is the primary need, and what's the peripheral need? So yeah, the wisdom is there. And, you know, depending on the age of the person, too. Let me just see, Joshua had a question, he's patient over here. He writes, when Rambam says in the Mishnah Torah that a Noachide may keep more laws if they do so to receive reward, what reward does he speak of? Joshua, he's speaking of the same reward that a Jew would get. No different. And again, we talked last week about, you know, this is predicated on the fact that he's keeping the laws because he recognized that this, he either went in front of three Jews in the court, so now he's receiving the laws through transmission right back to Sinai. That means he's keeping what he knows God commanded, as opposed to a Gentile who just keeps the laws because, you know, it makes sense to have a society where you don't kill, you don't rape, you don't steal. So then he's not doing it because he draws close to God. He's doing it for pragmatic, you know, practical purposes. So then that reward is not there. He's not really drawing close to God in that matter. He's not doing it because God said so. Like I said last week, I believe that a person today is, you know, Noachai, is in contact with Jews, and they have the conviction that Sinai took place. And it's clear to their minds that the laws that they have as Noachai is straight back to God, so then they are achieving that same reward. They are achieving that perfection. And they could keep all the laws and be living just as a Jew, and there'd be no difference whatsoever. We spoke about that a number of times. There's no difference whatsoever. Man is man. We all come from Adam and Eve. It's all the same exact design. So we all have the same exact potential. If you follow a reasonable lifestyle, well, you know, all these false ideas that people have, we can dispel.
Rabbi?
Yes.
We touched a little bit upon the temple. And I admit I'm remiss in my understanding or knowledge of it, but between the two temples, the first temple and the second temple, my understanding was I heard that the Shekhinah rested on the first temple but was not present in the second.
You mean the cloud? That I have to go back. I'm not 100% on what was lacking. I thought there was a difference. You are right. I mean, you're intuiting right that there was a difference in degree.
In my opinion, to me, I extract that if God's Shekhinah wasn't present in the second one, then does that mean that it wasn't valid? Or
no, it could just mean that there was a lesser degree of relationship between God and the people.
You know, makes sense.
That's what the...
I was just thinking in today's world, if some people just got together and decided that they wanted to rebuild the temple, would there be any credibility to that? You know, I just have a lot of curiosity about sort of the degrees.
Right. Well, that we can go into in terms of who would... does it have to be made by a certain individual? Is that something which is only for the Messiah to do? Is it something that only the king can do? Or could they build a temple even if they don't have somebody from David's lineage? And the location, how do we determine where the location is? Because it has to be built on the right spot. And what other considerations are there? Let's say it would, building the temple would generate such animosity in war. So do we risk people's lives because we want to have a temple? Some people might say yes. I don't know. That it doesn't seem to me that you risk people's lives for unnecessarily. The only time that you have to give over your life is, you know, in terms of idolatry, adultery, and murder, if somebody's forcing you. But to do something, any law, and you see that by doing it is going to get you killed, so you don't do it. Because the Torah says you should live by the Torah and not die by it. Mm-hmm. So that is a general rule, that you do not do something. If somebody says, you know, break the Sabbath or I'll kill you, you break the Sabbath. Somebody tells you, eat pork or I'll kill you, you have to eat it. Again, there are considerations in terms of whether he's doing that in front of a public display to ridicule God in Judaism. I believe in those cases, even those, you would have to be killed, if it's for that reason. But to do something where it's going to invite the deaths of others, you shouldn't. So there's a lot of considerations to what has to be done. But that's the overriding consideration. You don't want to lose life.
Mm-hmm.
And certainly, if they would build a temple right now where the mosque is, forget it. You'd have all out war.
Yeah.
I mean, you have it anyway. You do nothing, and you have it. So, that's something which we'll have to wait and see how that's going to unfold. But for sure, what they should be doing is living properly. They should not be giving all these concessions in and trying to look good in the public eye. There's no confidence in God's promises. Of course, we don't rely on miracles. You're not supposed to do something to rely on a miracle to save yourself, but you definitely shouldn't be doing things that are endangering Jews. You have these 440 prisoners that they just let out, and an act of goodwill in order to, be a nice entree to these, Annapolis summit. It just doesn't, these weren't the ones that had the blood on their hands. It doesn't make sense. These were captured people. They must have been doing something wrong. That's why they were imprisoned. But there's no, listen, they're not following God. God is not, invited to the peace talks, basically. It's all human considerations. Political and, military considerations, but there's really no reflection on the Torah's truth, which is a real contradiction, because the only reason you have the Jewish land as being ours is because it's based on a biblical source. So they're selectively reading the Torah. And it's surprising, a guy like, President Bush, who's such a staunch Christian, and he believes in the Bible and all, but, when it comes to things that go against American policy or American goals, and then, selectively passes over those pages. Same thing with Olmert. If you're going to say that you are following the Bible, well, why don't you, follow what it says? And if you, you know, if you're going to be sitting on Israel land and claiming it, so why are you just reading that part of Genesis and not the rest of it? But listen, hopefully more religious people will, you know, be elected to position, and these people will be, you know, incorporating, you know, real Torah truths into running the country. And but I think that may be why, you know, Messiah is part of the whole system of Torah, because God saw the future and how it became such a fragmented world of Judaism, this type, this flavor of Judaism, that flavor of Judaism. And the only real way to have it unified again under one system is if everybody does believe in one tenet, and that's that there is this Messiah, and he will then get the ear of all groups, and everybody will just have to, you know, fall into place and listen, and he'll unify the system once again. But there's a lot of things he has to do before he gets there. You fight God's wars, and build the temple on its spot, and he has to be from the lineage of David. So it's not a small feat. But hopefully, look, we pray for it every day in the Shemona Esrei. Three times a day we pray for the rebuilding of Israel, of Jerusalem, and I hope to see it soon. Because that would really be the state of, as we started out talking, where a man's best state is where he's naturally drawn to wisdom. And that will be the change that God will, you know, put into effect in the future. And Rosora has a comment. Let me just read what she writes. I was thinking that perhaps we can keep studying Torah even when we perform enjoyable activities. We can try to understand or recognize God's wisdom all the time by observing creation. Will that still be considered studying Torah? Yes, I mean, Maimonides actually says that, Rosora. He says that if a person wants to draw close to the love of God, he should study the universe. So a person definitely can do that. And, you know, be involved in other activities when you go sightseeing or go on vacation. All right, any other questions?
Not at this moment, but thank you. This has been very helpful.
Yeah, good.
Yeah, very enjoyable.
Okay, and a lot of this I wrote up. You get the Jewish Times for this week on the cover, on God's plan for mankind. But there's more to it. I added more. I didn't go over all the points. But as a review, so you can read that and you see the other points in terms of seeing how it's coming full circle, that it really is a plan, and all the verses talk about it. And I quote Jeremiah in there also, that Nachmanides quoted Ramban. He quoted something in there. So you can take a look at that. And then there's also... There's also the history of Hanukkah, so you can read up on that too. A couple of years ago, I translated on Purim, we have this thing called the Megillas Esther, the letter of Esther that we read in Purim. Evidently, there was also a letter of Antiochus, meaning a history of what took place on Hanukkah, the whole event, and who were the players, and the wars, and a very detailed historical account. So I translated a few years ago, and it's in this week's Jewish Times in the back. I put like a Hanukkah insert. So it's called the Megillas Antiochus, the Hanukkah story. So if you want to read the history, and actually this was found in a ancient siddur in Greek, in Greece. And the siddur, the prayer book, the Hebrew prayer book that I have, it refers to this as a precious letter, meaning it's there's a lot to be derived from that. So it's a rare find, and it was only in Hebrew, but now you have the English, so I hope I did a good job on it, and you can take a look.
We'll look forward to it.
Okay. All right, so so maybe since next week is Chanukah, I'll look up and we'll start maybe do some ideas on the philosophy that we apropos regarding what we can extract from Hanukkah.
Okay, that would be great.
All right. All right, then. So until then, we'll pick up again next week, back to regular time, 11:15. next Sunday. Alrighty?
Okay. That sounds great, and you have a great week and a great introduction to Hanukkah.
Okay, thanks a lot.
Alrighty. Thanks, Rabbi. Take care.
Okay, be well.
Thanks so much, Rabbi.
You're welcome. Take care, and Joshua, Rosora, have a good week also. Take care, everybody.